Joel, you want to know something?
What?
Every now and then, say what the f***. What the f*** gives you freedom? Freedom brings opportunity. Opportunity makes your future. If you can't say it, you can't do it.
Welcome to Sailing in the Mediterranean podcast. I'm your host. My name is Franz. I had a great week last week, and what made it particularly fun was I got a call from Dan. Dan's one of my listeners. He lives in Connecticut and works in New York City as a French horn player in various Broadway productions as well as the New York Ballet. He's the individual who wrote me and asked me about sailing through the Mediterranean. And if you recall, he outlined what his plan was. And I said, Dan, it's a great plan, but you're going way too fast. Slow down, slow down. It's like roller skating through the Louvre. Take your time, enjoy your time. So Dan sent me another email, said thanks for the information, and I told him, I said, hey, if you're ever out here to ski, give me a call, we'll go skiing, and he did it. Now, I'm not much of a Twitter guy or a Facebook guy, and I know Neil is taking care of that for me, and I'm getting on there a little bit right now, but what I like are real friendships and real relationships, not necessarily cyber ones. So when I have the opportunity to meet people, I usually take advantage of that opportunity. So we spent a day skiing, and Dan gave me some leads of possible people I might want to interview, and the people I'm going to interview today are one of those leads, Paul and Cheryl Shard from Distant Shores. Now, this is going to be the first of probably many podcasts and interviews that I do with these folks because they've had a lot of sailing experience, both in the Mediterranean and the Caribbean, all around, and they're good people to talk to. They give a good interview. They make TV shows that you can purchase, and I'm going to put some links to their TV shows. Half-hour segments of various places about cruising and sailing, and they've been all over. So I'm looking forward to many, many more interviews with them, and I wanted to get this episode out quickly because they're going to be at the Toronto Boat Show January 9th. So normally I would have recorded this and done some editing and put it in the queue, but I'm going to get this one out right away. I have another interview that I did with Bud, my friend Bud, who's a good friend who's sailed with me multiple times. And the interview with Bud was really on cooking and cooking for crews because Bud's done several trans-pack races. And he's been the cook for the crew, and I wanted to get some of his ideas for cooking on a boat because it's an underrated thing. You don't think about the food, but food is very important on a boat. So I'm going to put that one off a little later. Maybe in another week or so I'll post that one. And I will get this one out right away. And also I will put links to their website at my website, medsailor.com. And if you click those links, it'll take you into their website. And if you have any interest in their TV shows, I've looked at a couple. They're pretty well done. Very, very well done. And they're not too expensive. That's how they make their living sailing, is sailing their TV series. I got a letter from Ted. Ted was the first purchaser of my ASA 103 audio lessons. And I just sent him a quick note saying, hey, thanks a lot. You're my first customer. And he wrote me back, said, sir, hey, you don't need to call me sir. Just say Franz. I really liked your style and your sample for 103. Your podcasts of your travels are a class act, sir. And your name tells me we may both be Germans. LOL. I'm afraid I am one who has moderate experience, owns a 27-foot Newport on a very large inland lake, Lake Pend Oreille in Idaho. Sailed my entire life on small boats and crewed across the Northwest Caribbean, teaching myself dead reckoning, but have no certificates and want to bareboat. I'll listen to your classes on a long upcoming drive and then test out of ASA 101. I have McGregor 26 reserved in La Paz, Baja for my 50th birthday for a week in April and have no concerns since I'll stay in sheltered waters. But your classes, I purchased ASA 101 and 103, seem perfect. Thank you, sir, and may you enjoy many sails ahead. Kind regards, Ted. Ted, thanks a lot for your comments. Thanks for your endorsement. And my first name is German. I was named after my great-grandfather, who had six daughters and no sons. And my grandmother named my father after him as well. And my father, who really liked him as a grandfather, named me after him as well. Since he couldn't pass on his name to his children, I got to be named after him. But when he came to America, and this is back in the early 1900s, or the early 20th century, he changed his name from Franz, which is his German spelling, to Francis, which is more of an American spelling. And my father was named Francis. And my father, who really liked the old guy, named me after him, back to the original spelling, Franz, F-R-A-N-Z. Now, I'm probably maybe 25% German, but most of my heritage is Scandinavian, primarily Danish, and a little bit of Scottish in there as well. We have a family tart, Campbells of Crenage, as I recall. But German's in there. I'm typical American. I'm Heinz 57. I'm part of the melting pot. I wish I spoke German, but I don't. I'm typical American. I don't speak any other foreign languages. So I'm going to give myself a quick plug. If you are studying for the ASA 101 or the 103, I have a series of audio lessons available. You can buy them at the website, medsailor.com, and they are also available. Well, the 101 is available in iTunes, and it'll be a while before the 103 is available in iTunes. I'm working on the 104 right now, and I can tell that's going to be a long slog to get through all the topics on that. It appears to me that they cover the same material over and over and over again in the various lessons, because some of the lessons and questions that you have to deal with are exactly the same as in the previous examination, particularly a lot of the rules of the road. So anyway, if you are interested in purchasing those lessons, I appreciate your support. With that out of the way, I'm going to get straight into the interview today, and I'm not going to go through our quick quiz of rules of the road because I just want to get this out so that if you're up in Canada and you're going to the Toronto Boat Show, you will have a chance to go visit Distant Shores TV, Cheryl and Paul Shard. I do appreciate comments from listeners, and if you're out in Salt Lake and you're going skiing, drop me a note. We can always do a few runs together. I'm talking to Paul and Cheryl Shard. I came across Paul and Cheryl's website as a result of talking to one of my listeners, Dan, and I won't give his last name because I don't know if he wants his last name out there, but he told me he enjoyed your TV series. He's planning to do a transatlantic and sail into the Mediterranean next year. And he and I have had a few discussions. I was able to ski with him last week at Snowbird. And he said he really enjoyed your videos. And so I reached out to you, and I wanted to find out what you're doing and tell us about your adventures.
Well, thanks, Franz. Yes, well, Paul and I love cruising. We've been sailing for 25 years. We set sail on our first cruise in 1989 on a 37-foot sailboat that we built ourselves with the plans of doing a two-year sabbatical to the Caribbean and over to the Mediterranean. And that trip ended up being a three-year Atlantic Circle. And we have continued to cruise. We never did do the settling down part. But as television producers and filmmakers, we documented that first trip, and Discovery Channel licensed it. And then people like that, and it's continued to be a lifestyle and a career for us as we document our adventures and share the experiences with other people that want to cruise and explore by boat.
Okay. So you've been all through the Mediterranean. You've been all around the Atlantic. You've been all through the Caribbean. Where else have you been?
Well,
we sailed up through Europe. We sailed north to Norway and Scotland and Ireland and Sweden, Denmark, Germany, Holland, France, England. We sailed through the French canals and down to the Mediterranean, an interesting option for people heading to the Mediterranean from Europe. So that was a very fun trip, too.
Wow, so many things to talk about. I think I'm going to have you back for several interviews.
Oh, please do.
Because you have a lot of stories to tell, and I want to learn as much from you as I'm sure my listeners do as well. So tell me about your first trip to the Mediterranean, your passage, and some of the places you visited, some of the experiences you had. I went onto your website. I was looking at destinations. And you have a whole bunch in the Mediterranean. I think you have, I'm looking at it right now, the Balearic Islands, Croatia, Gibraltar, Greek Islands, Malta, Sardinia, Sicily, Italy, Venice, Aeolian Islands. And I'm curious to find out your experiences in the Aeolian Islands because I had my own, Spain and Tunisia. That's what I can see on the screen. So
we went to a lot more than that even. I just haven't put them all up on the website. That was a start anyway. We did the whole, we went to the Middle East, we went to Syria and Lebanon and Egypt and Israel and Turkey, the Turkish Cyprus, mm-hmm. and Greek Cyprus. We got up to Istanbul. Every single one of those, we filmed the experience and made a television show. The program is half hour long, so we for instance, Istanbul, I think it spilled over into two programs because yes. It was pretty exciting and sailing up through the Dardanelles. The Aeolian Islands, I think we did three shows.
Yes, covering that.
Sailing
cruise.
Around that area. So
yeah, Italy's lots of fun. Yeah. Well, we've spent over 9 years, I guess it's 11 years now, cruising the Mediterranean at various times. And as Paul said, we've documented all our experiences for the Distant Shores series. And, just showing the highlights of the things you can see and do there, some of the navigational challenges in certain places, such as going through the Straits of Gibraltar. And some of the shallow water you encounter in the Greek islands. And so it's a mix. The program is a mix of travel adventure and how to, and many sailors find it inspiring as they're planning their own trip. But yes, definitely the first crossing there from North America was memorable and exciting.
Yeah. Storms on the way across the Atlantic to find that one. It was 18-day passage from Bermuda to the Azores, and probably our roughest sail ever. But
I think it all the time. Yeah. That was in 1990. We had cruised we had sailed from Toronto, our home base, down the Intracoastal Waterway to Florida and spent a winter in the Bahamas and really spent that time trying to build up our offshore experience, doing night sailing whenever we could and offshore more than one night at sea to build up our passage time. And after that, I guess it was a year and a half, we felt ready and we thought, well, we'll do the first jump from Florida to to Bermuda. And see how that goes. That was 8 days. And we both felt good and confident. And then we knew it was a big stretch on the next jump to the Azores. And but we were pretty nervous. We'd never done such a big crossing before. And it was there in May, which is May and June is the best time to do a crossing from North America to Europe. Just because it's a little bit before hurricane season and the winds are generally pretty stable. So we got to Bermuda, no problem. There were lots of sailors there kind of batching up, waiting for a weather window. And we kept getting front after front coming down from the U.S. And we started to lose our nerve just waiting. And then finally it looked like we had a break and a bunch of us jumped off. But it really was too soon, and we got hit with a storm within 24 hours that the front predicted came a little faster.
Let me ask you a quick question on that, on the weather routing. Were you at that time, was Herb on Southbound 2 making walking sailors across the Atlantic, or was that
before? Wow, yeah, that's fantastic. We actually know Herb from before. So when we had sailed to Bermuda that time, he was in Bermuda doing his weather routing. And we went out, Herb took us out as we were still trying to hook up our HF radio to get talking to people.
Yeah, Herb.
And to him. So Herb drove us around Bermuda and we got pieces and assembled the backstay system for our first crossing and our first radio setup.
We built our first boat and we're members of the Ontario Boat Builders Cooperative, and Herb Hilgenberg also built his boat. So we knew him from home, from Canada. And he was just starting off then, and he was actually holding a full-time job in Bermuda and doing radio checks at that time in the morning and the afternoon. So
he just did an amazing service. Yeah. It's just fantastic.
He did. And, you know, one of my big mistakes is I have a ham radio license and I tune my radio to 20 meters because it's a good long distance frequency for sailors. And I tuned it so I adjusted my Kenwood TS-440S so I could also broadcast on maritime frequencies. But unfortunately, I had such a mismatch on my antenna that I could listen to Herb, but I couldn't transmit to him. When I sailed across, I made the big mistake of sailing straight to the Azores from Hampton, Virginia, and my weather was absolutely atrocious, and it sounds like yours was too, which surprises me, because I hear coming up from Bermuda, that's supposed to be the easiest, the best way to go.
Well, it was the second time we did it, so we've done it two times that direction, that same passage, so if we'd waited, I think, a day and a half or 2 days, the people we talked to who were behind us had a wonderful time and everything was easy. And
that was, I truly believe it was just our lack of experience at the time. We were getting impatient and we thought, well, let's just go for it. It looks like we can get out from under this. And we didn't. And you know, now we know, how bad could it be to wait another few days in Bermuda? Like, come on.
And we hadn't used Herb for weather routing before because we hadn't had our radio. And I think we certainly couldn't blame Herb for this because we never actually asked him. He helped us hook up the radio and then we just sort of jumped off and left. And I think the first day we called in and said, hey, Herb, we're out here. And he's like,
oh, my gosh,
why did you leave?
But anyway, we got through it. We had gusting winds of like 50 knots. We had, the Coast Guard was saying, waves of 25 feet, like a two-story house. And, you know, we faced the nightmare. We took care of each other. The boat took care of us, and we got through it. And after that, I think I relaxed totally with offshore passengers because I realized, hey, we can get through this and manage it. I'm going to be smarter about waiting for the best weather to make it a great passage. And we've never had, you know, such adventures again over the 25 years. And it's just all about experience and patience. And now, you know, with being able to download GRIB files and so on, you can get very good weather forecasting and see what's going on.
Things have changed a lot. We didn't even have a GPS on that crossing, so it was a long time ago.
That's about 7 years before my crossing. So, and when I sailed across in 97, Herb, I could hear Herb, and I wasn't listening to him until I got to the Azores. And then once I listened to his advice in the Azores, the passage from there to Lagos, Portugal was delightful. Just the most wonderful sailing experience I think I've ever had. It was perfect weather. So he was really helpful to me on the second part of my passage, and the first part of my passage, just like you, I wasn't following his advice. So.
Well, when we started, you know, listening to him and checking in with him regularly, I learned so much about weather following that net because, you know, he'd explain what was going on so well, and then I'd hear what sailors maybe 100 or 200 miles ahead or behind of us were experiencing. And it was really a great, great opportunity. Herb.
Yeah, I do too. It's, you know, he did so much good for so long. I just wish somebody had taken over what he was doing because he was a legend in the cruising community. So anyway, so you got to the Azores. How long did you spend in the Azores?
The first time we were there, we planned to spend a week or two. But then when we got there, we just fell in love with the place and spent the entire summer. Mm-hmm. So we explored all of the islands with the exception of Corvo, which doesn't have a harbor. So we just loved it. We spent, I guess it was 8 weeks there. And then we sailed on to Gibraltar and then spent the winter. And the next summer, we went actually back to the Azores again. So we've had a couple of whole summers there now. It's just mm-hmm. one of our favorite places.
When was the last time you were in the Mediterranean, and did you have to deal with the VAT tax situation? Is that something that you're concerned mm-hmm. about?
Yeah, we were there recently.
2012.
Well, 2012 we were there as we came through France and then headed down to Gibraltar. And we were also there in 2000. We came over about 1999,
our second
transatlantic, and then spent the next 8 years in the Mediterranean. So in that case, we were always popping down. You know, we'd go to Tunisia or at that point you could go to Malta before Malta officially joined. So we were in Malta for one winter and Gibraltar for one season to try to avoid, you know, the VAT. But mm-hmm. now that it's 18 months, it's a lot easier to deal with than it used to be.
Yeah, then it was 6 months.
Yeah.
And also we learned that you could actually stop the clock if you were leaving your boat. You could do what they call sealing your boat. So say we'd cruised for 4 months into our 18 months and we wanted to leave the boat in Spain, we would haul the boat out or store it in the water and go to customs and say, we're flying home for 3 months. Can we seal the boat? And they would come and put a little sticker on it and no one could use the boat during that time. And that would stop the clock for the 3 months that we were away. And then when we came back, they would start the time again. So we stretched out the 18 months a few times doing that in various countries.
I'm not sure if you can still do that. Do you know if you can still do that?
My understanding is you cannot do that anymore. And that's how I sailed through the Mediterranean the first time. Is I'd go over for 2 months at a time, come home, go over for another 2 months, come home. And the longest period I was really on my boat was the first time I sailed over, and that was 3 months. Well, actually 4 months in Spain and the Balearics. And then after that, I was always just 2 months at a time. So, and then I, just like you, I went from Italy down to Malta and the clock started over at that point in time. But now, then Croatia used to be out of it. And now they're part of it. So there's no place to hide anymore.
Right.
Well, you can still go to wonderful Turkey. So
that's true. And that's where my boat's been for many years for that exact reason. So,
Where do you keep it in Turkey?
Tunisia works too, of course. So
right. And I haven't been to Tunisia. If you've been there, I'd like to get a report from you, but maybe we'll just save that for another time if we don't get that far this time. I've kept my boat all up and down the coast from Ivalik all the way down to...
Oh, we love Ivalik.
Yeah, Ivalik is a great, great marina. And I've been as far south as Kemmer. I haven't wintered in Kemmer, but I've wintered in Finicky on the south side. So I've been
gorgeous.
Up and down the coast. The center marinas are wonderful marinas through there, and they manage them very well. And then I've also left my boat several times at a boatyard near Bodrum called Yacht Lift. And I don't know if you've used that boatyard either.
No, I know it's outside of Bodrum, isn't it?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've not been in there, but I've looked at it as we go past. So
anyway, so you cleared in and you spent the first winter in Gibraltar. Now, are you living on board your boat 12
yes.
months a year?
At that point, we lived on the boat for 36 months straight. Didn't even visit home at all. So that was our first trip. And then on our second trip, as we did all the 8 years in the Med, we were living on the boat for sort of about 6 to 8 months of every year, and then 3 and 4, 5 months at home editing the TV shows, because they have to be all finished professionally and get off to the broadcasters. They're broadcast around the world, so... that would be our home time, and then we were back on the boat again.
Mm-hmm. So. And that turned out to be a very nice balance for us, because then we were, you know, we had our feet in both camps. We could connect with family and work colleagues when we were home, and yet still enjoy lots of time on the boat. And it meant that our batteries were recharged all the time. Wherever we were keen to get back to the other. We enjoyed it so much when we got back to the boat. We enjoyed it so much when we got home. On our first trip, which was full-time for the three-year Atlantic Circle, we found we did get a bit travel-weary towards the end. We were taking things for granted that were, you know, beautiful and amazing to us in the first year and a bit of cruising. And we just got impatient with the language barriers and so on. So for us, anyway, we found this part-time cruising where we're on the boat a lot of the year and then sometime a home is just great for us. We never get tired of what we're doing.
That's interesting you say that, because I think a lot of people have this fantasy about what it's really like to be out on a boat all the time. There's a lot of headaches.
Yeah, that's what they say. Cruising is fixing your boat in exotic places.
That's true. Yeah.
And it's always so nice when we get home and the wind is howling and the windows are rattling. And it's like, we don't have to worry about the house dragging.
Don't think so, anyway.
Yeah, so far not.
It's funny you think that, because that's exactly what I think when I'm at home. I'm thinking, let it blow, let it blow, let it blow.
Yeah. And then just turn the tap on and brush while you brush your teeth for 5 minutes. And let the water run down the drain.
Bubble baths.
Yeah.
But the short, you know, very soon we're itching to get back on the water. And I'm sure you agree. It is such a great lifestyle. It's so healthy. You know, you're meeting new people. Every day is different and interesting. It's just a wonderful lifestyle. And I think all of us that get a chance to do it, no matter how long or short a time, we're just so blessed.
So you wintered in Gibraltar, right at the marina in Gibraltar there?
Yes, yeah, it's Marina Bay is where we stayed. That's okay. The one that's just at the runway.
Right, okay. Uh-huh.
And at that point, we've been cruising almost 2 years, and it was nice to stop in a place and get to know people and know where things are. And, you know, we had work to do on the boat. We'd lived aboard, you know, for the first time for a couple of years. So we had new ideas of changes we wanted to make to the boat. So it was a great spot for us. And English is spoken, so it made it easy for us rather than being in a country where there might be a language barrier.
Right. And you can get pretty much any supplies you need right there in Gibraltar as well.
Yeah, Jib's great for all of that. So, yeah, it was super. So that cruise, we headed on to along the Spanish coast sort of quickly and spent some time in the Balearic Islands. And that was as much as we did on the Mediterranean, that first trip. Mm-hmm. But then when we came back, we really want to see the Mediterranean really in depth. So that was 1998, 99 as we entered the Mediterranean. So then we really tried to stop as many places as we could. And I think it was about 8 years. We did about 7 or 8 months every single year on the boat in the Mediterranean.
Yeah. And we would just work our way slowly exploring and filming for the Distant Shore show and then leave the boat in a place, you know, that was recommended by other sailors. So we're members of the Seven Seas Cruising Association, and there was always good information there about where to leave our boats based on other sailors' recommendations, and also the Cruising Association in the UK.
So when you sailed over and you went to the Balearics, then did you sail back to the Caribbean at that point in time and then come back across a second time then?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, almost exactly. We went to the Balearics, then we went back out. I don't think anyone's ever done this. We went to Gibraltar again, and then we headed straight out to the Azores to revisit the Azores, which we'd fallen in love with, then popped down to Madeira, and we were filming underwater with whales, sperm whales in the Azores, and we're getting into underwater filming back then, so we sailed on down to Brazil to film dolphins, and we hit it kind of all over the road.
Yeah,
kind of.
Our trip back was
a lot of miles.
Azores, Madeira, Canary Islands, then our longest passage, 20 days at sea from Las Palmas to Fernando de Noronha in Brazil, where we filmed spinner dolphins, which there's only two places in the world that they know of them coming towards shore to breed. They're pelagic dolphins. And they're fantastic. They leap out of the water and they can rotate 9 times. It's just like you don't even see the dolphin. You just see this pinwheel of water as they leap. So we filmed that. And then from there, we sailed straight along the South American coast back to the Caribbean to meet family for Christmas. So we're hoping to return to South America at some point to spend a bit more time there.
So did you sail along Venezuela, Trinidad, Tobago, Colombia, that area then?
No, we sailed from Brazil along the north coast, passing the entrance of the Amazon River.
Yes, we sailed straight up to Grenada at that point.
Grenada. Okay, okay.
And then to Grenada and then north through the Leeward Windward Islands.
When you went by the mouth of the Amazon River, how far out did you have to go to avoid the tidal wave that I guess is created
there? We were 200 miles.
We were a long way off. We were like 150 miles offshore. And there was no bad currents or anything. But still, even that far off, there was the one day when we came right up to the line in the water where there was the beautiful Atlantic blue water and then an absolute line with this sort of brown Amazon muddy water.
It was amazing.
Really strange.
Huh.
It was a nice passage. It was one of the fastest we ever did in that boat because we got all this current behind us as you come up along the current is just sweeping along at almost a knot and a half.
Yeah,
the
didn't
whole
we
passage.
Get like about 50 miles a day?
Yeah, we could get 50 miles a day. It was incredible.
Oh, wow.
So when that current finally ran out near the Caribbean, we felt like we were going really slow.
Yeah, it's a strange passage.
Now, when you're filming, are you filming with just the two of you?
Yes, we are. Yeah, we're...
Yeah, we mount cameras around the boat and, do lots of extra tricks to try to get as many shots as we need to really document the story properly. And
yeah, we have camera booms that get aerial shots of the boat sailing, and we really have fun with that. It's like, how can we tell this story visually? And then we do all the editing and scripting as well. So again, we have fun sort of tricking the edits so it looks like we have a big crew filming with us.
Well, when you're doing underwater photography, that's difficult to do as well. Do you do that anymore? Have you pretty much dropped that now?
I love underwater. I'm doing even more of it than ever, I think. Wow. We did a lot this summer. I have all kinds of strange rigs. I can set up tripods underwater, and I do all kinds of unusual. I really have a lot of fun with that. This summer we were filming blue holes in the Bahamas and filming dolphins underwater and
all kinds of unusual,
all kinds of other strange
life.
Animals.
Paul is a very good breath holder, so he does most of his underwater filming free diving, which means the animals aren't afraid of him because there's no bubbles and shiny danglies. And so he gets some really different kinds of shots. And of course, in the Bahamas, where the water's so shallow, you can get beautiful images in quite shallow water.
Now, what about your audio? Are you recording audio separately and then syncing it up as you do your post-production then?
We mostly don't do that. We do occasionally do that when we do two or three camera shoots. Like if we've got two cameras going, then we're probably just recording on external onto our big XD cam camera.
Mm-hmm.
It's got two mics into that, so we'll have the wireless and the regular mic, and then we can sync up any other cameras that we're shooting at the same time. So like if we're shooting with a GoPro at the same time, you can sync the audio from the good camera into the GoPro.
So, okay.
And get that synced together.
I'm looking at your shot here from your website. It looks like it's a fixed image shot, but boy, that's a wide angle lens because the curve of the earth is way behind you. It goes way up and way down. It must be a huge wide angle lens you use for that shot there.
Yeah, those are fun. We do have fun trying to really capture as much of the cruising experience as we can to really help show people what it's like to be out cruising and the sort of the cruising experience. And I just love the photography challenge of just trying to capture as much of that as you can. Like, we did a big project to try to capture night sailing, so I've been working hard on sort of night shots and just to sort of bring all of that into the TV show because viewers around the world, it's nice we get so many fan letters from people mm-hmm. who are seeing the show in different, where it's on around the world on TV. And we've met cruisers who've there's a bunch of people from South Africa we met last summer who had watched the show on television in South Africa and then bought boats and sailed off. And I've always been proud that I think they're doing okay, and they feel that they, I guess they've learned enough out of the show or got a reasonable impression of what cruising and sailing, living aboard was like.
And that the world can be very friendly. And,
yeah.
You know, you can make the experience yourself, good or bad, based on your attitude. And everyone we've met that has watched the show and been inspired by it or used it to help them plan their own trips, yeah, seem to be having a good experience. So we feel really good about that because we feel very lucky to be doing what we do. And so many people helped us when we first got started. And so it's nice to be able to share what we've learned to help others have a good time too.
Now let's talk about some of the actual mechanics of sailing. Do you maintain the boat yourself? Do you hire people out? Do you have people come over and join you for different parts of the trip?
Well, we do sometimes, but I mean, we look at it that we are working because we are pretty much full time recording and editing and working on the TV show. So we do have our family come as guests, and it's great to have them. But by and large, we're just the two of us on the boat, and that works pretty great.
We're very lucky. Our parents are neighbors, so they travel together and come at least once a year, and also good friends.
In terms of working on the boat, basically we do everything on the boat. With our first boat, we built it from a bare hull and deck.
Now, what kind of boat was that?
It's a Sparkman Stevens Classic 37, so it looks a lot like an Alberg design or Cape Dory type of keel.
Okay, it's full keel, bowsprit, boomkin?
Didn't have a bowsprit, but yeah, a full keel and long overhangs, sort of graceful looking and, not a lot of space inside.
Not a lot of space, yeah.
So we built that boat, so we learned a lot about boats, and then we bought a Southerly yacht, which is a shallow draft boat, because we found we enjoyed the Bahamas and mm-hmm. had always wanted to do canals and rivers and stuff like that. So we wanted a shallow boat. But now I do all the work on those. We hire somebody sometimes like to do bottom paint or, but otherwise I do everything, engine repairs, electrical add-ons and
I think that's added
rigging,
a lot to our sort of comfort and freedom while cruising because we both work together building the boat. We have skills to repair. Paul, far better than me, but it means that if things break down, we're really not held up by it because we know how to fix them and we carry spares and the proper tools to do everything. So that has really given us a lot of freedom and it saves a lot of money too.
Oh, yes. Yeah, actually, I'm looking at your website and I see the first boat, our first sailboat. Yeah, that's a nice looking hull design you have on that one. And it looks like it's semi-modified full keel, so it was fairly maneuverable in tight spaces, it looks like it would be. Is that right?
Yes, it is. It's quite right on that. You couldn't back it up, but with the cutaway keel and the cutaway forefoot, you could definitely turn on a dime. And I think she was a pretty comfortable boat in terms of soft motion, but the modern long waterline boat was much more comfortable at sea, that's for sure, the new boat.
We did 3 transatlantic crossings with that first boat and 60,000 nautical miles with her. And so we had her for 18 years. But we really wanted to do the French canals, and 6-foot draft was a little tight for that. So Paul started coming up with ways or ideas for cutting down the keel and adding a bulb. And I just thought, wow, if we're getting to that, maybe it's time for a new boat. So we moved to the Southerly 42, which we loved, and did 16,000 nautical miles with that. And we're now sailing on a Southerly 49 with the same swing keel and really enjoying it in shallow water and creeks and places like that. Yet at sea, she draws 10 feet with the keel down. So she's a really good deep draft boat as well.
Hmm. So when you went through the French canals, what was the draft that you could go through the French canals with?
I think 1.8 meters or 6 feet is the limit. But, you know, they're old canals and a lot of times there wasn't that much water. So we'd been advised that, you know, a 5-foot draft was probably the most you would want to to do with that, because there's a lot of commercial traffic, and when the barges come through, you have to move to the side, and the sides are sloped up. So if you draw 6 feet, you know, you're on the ground. So with the keel up on the southerly, we draw less than a meter. So it's only 2'10". So we could sneak through. And for her length, Distant Shores 2 is the name of our boat. She's pretty narrow. So we just fit in the locks pretty snugly. And the lock keepers were all taking pictures of the boat because they'd never seen a sailboat that size go through the little canals. So that was fun.
Okay, yeah, I'm looking at the pictures of it right now. So 13 feet 9 inches wide. So that'll fit through the locks okay then.
Yes, yeah. And that was a great trip and a fabulous way to get to the Med if you know, you're up in the UK or Scandinavia. It's we spent 10 weeks traveling from the English Channel, from the North Coast. We sailed up the Seine to Paris. And I mean, to arrive in Paris in your own boat, like right by the Eiffel Tower, where you can reach out and touch it almost. And we stayed at the Arsenal Basin, right by the Bastille. I mean, it was a fantastic way to see the city. And then we continued on through these really little narrow canals that went through wine country. And, you know, you'd stop for lunch. There were all the restaurants had docks and you could go to wineries and taste wine and load the boat up with, for the, you know, next little while. We basically ate and drank our way across France. It was we're still paying the price for that.
Getting back to the Mediterranean, I ask you about the French canals. I interviewed one person back in one of my earlier podcasts. He's a Brit, and he's spent a lot of time sailing from Britain down to the Mediterranean and back up through the French canals. And it's been one of the things I've wanted to do for a long time, but I just debate whether with a full keel boat, aft-hung rudder, my 5-foot draft, whether my boat would be maneuverable enough to really get through the canals, because it just does not turn on a dime like I might be needing to be. But I've had people say, well, just sell your boat and get another boat. But it's easier said than done.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we've had friends with deeper draft. There are routes you can do if you have a deep draft sailboat, but they're a little bigger rivers and a bit more commercial. But you still get the experience. I mean, my goodness, you're in France with your boat. And, a lot of people spend years just exploring the canals in France. We shot 5 episodes about going through the French canals for season 9 of Distant Shores.
Yeah, those are some of our most popular episodes, aren't they?
Yeah, and we did a lot of how-to in that about, you know, how to properly fender your boat and prepare it for the canals. You know, basically you make your boat rectangular with fender boards and leave them down the whole time. But it was so much fun. And then to get to the Med and become a sailboat once again and, you know, head off. And that same summer we crossed the Atlantic on our 5th transatlantic. So we did these little wee canals and then an ocean the same year. So it was a great year.
On the French canals, you've got to be right at the helm all the time. So you can't put it on autopilot and just sit back and have a cup of coffee. You've got to be paying attention all the time.
Oh, yeah, but if you want to have a cup of coffee, you've got an amazing patisserie to go to have it. So,
yeah, yeah.
So that was pretty funny because the locks keepers would close at 12, except if it was 10 to 12, then they wouldn't let you in anyway because then they wouldn't be able to finish at 12, you know. So
lunch is sacred.
Lunch is a sacred hour. So we started to plan our cruising around this so we'd make sure we'd arrive at a place where there was a little restaurant to have an amazing lunch, and we'd pull over and tie up, just bang the stakes into the, we had these little pick stakes like you could use as a sort of temporary cleat. So attach yourself to the bank and tie the boat up and go ashore. And there'd be a lunch for 10 or 11 euros that included wine
and jour.
Menu of the day. And, oh, it was amazing. We ate and drank our way across France. It was fantastic.
We're doing seminars on the French canals and cruising in the Bahamas and Caribbean at the Toronto Boat Show, because people are very fascinated with France and especially the Mediterranean coast.
Yeah, it was a very fun trip, very fun.
So this is next week. Give me the specific dates and where you'll be.
Okay, we'll be in Toronto at the Exhibition Center, and it's from January 9th to the 18th. And Paul and I will be speaking every day. We're doing seminars on cruising the French canals, cruising the Bahamas and Caribbean, and also how to provision for cruising. And when we're not speaking, we'll be at the speaker's booth, which is booth number 1794 in the sailboat section. It's a big show. There's sailboats and powerboats and all kinds of cottage boats, too, and it expands over several buildings. It's a real highlight for, you know, snowbound sailors in the northern U.S. and, of course, Canada.
Now, do you live right in Toronto? Are you near Toronto?
We're just about 2 hours north, so it's an easy drive down for us. So that's our big city hub.
Yeah, we live on the Trent Severn Waterway. So we're never away from water.
I don't know the waterways in Canada that well.
Yeah, this one, you know, the American, they call it the American Great Loop, and you can sort of cut around part of the United States.
No, I don't know anything about that, no.
Really?
No.
Oh, well,
you're a Mediterranean sailor.
Yes.
Well, and before I sailed across the Atlantic, I sailed up in the Northwest primarily, the Gulf Islands, the British Columbia.
Okay, well, this is a... If you looked at a map of the U.S., you can cut off the whole eastern part using the Mississippi River. So if you plan that, you could come down the Mississippi and enter the Gulf of Mexico, go all around the coast of the U.S. up the Intracoastal Waterway. And when you get to New York, you come up the Hudson and the Erie Canal, and now you're into the Great Lakes, and come around through the Great Lakes to Chicago and back down the waterway and make a big loop that sort of cuts off a big part of the U.S.
Okay, I'm familiar with that. I was just thinking of the Canadian waterways. I just interviewed Spike Hampson, and he's taking a little boat all the way. His goal is to get it down to Buenos Aires, but it's a little powerboat around 21 feet, I think 21 or 24 feet. And he just went through the Great Lakes, and he went through a canal that cut off one of the major Great Lakes, and was just a canal that took him right into Montreal. And I was wondering if that was part of that you're talking about.
Yeah, well, it's all related. There's all these different options. So that one, I think he would be coming up the Champlain.
Right.
Yeah. Instead of the Erie, he'd come the Champlain that takes you to Montreal, and then you could come up the St. Lawrence into Lake Ontario. And then if you wanted to miss Lake Erie altogether, you could cut through the Trent Severn, which would take you past our place in basically Ontario. And I think there's, 65 locks or something?
Right.
Something like that.
It takes you up to Georgian Bay, another great cruising area in the North Channel.
Yeah. So you can do that. So it's a very pretty area. Honestly, it's one of the prettiest little waterways, because it takes you to some beautiful cottage lakes, clear water and fish and nice swimming, nice summer. It's a big summer. It's all, where all the Torontonian people want to come in the summer to avoid the heat of the big city.
Yeah.
So when you got to the Balearics on this first trip over, you just went pretty much quickly up the coast of Spain because...
Yeah, we did it all in the spring. We did it. That was a quick trip. So in that case, we spent basically the spring in the Balearics. And then I think did we do it all in one big jump? We went from Estepona... down the water, down the Med, got beat up with a poignante wind banging us along and big waves, and just stopped for a morning and then headed on and did another jump and straight to the Balearics.
Okay, so that's a long... So I took a whole summer to get from Sevilla up to the Ibiza, Formentera, and then back to Alicante, where I left my boat that year.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah, those are all nice areas.
We spent a lot more time on our second trip through. That was the times that we were in the Med for like 8-9 years. So, yeah, we just worked our way along the southern coast, spent a lot of time in the Balearics, playing in the mud baths. And
now, I was looking at that. I don't remember those mud baths. I must have missed those entirely when I went through the Balearics. So,
well, if you're in Formentera... Just north of Formentera is Little Espalmador.
Okay.
That it's a pretty little anchorage, usually quite busy, and certainly a holiday weekend in the summer it'll be rocking and rolling. And then there's just these mud baths were just a natural formation in the middle of the island of Espalmador. If you anchor in the...
Yeah, you have to hike into the woods. So it was pretty private. And we filmed a fun kind of piece for the show on that. Where everybody,
it was our nudity episode.
We were totally covered in mud. And it, for the first, Paul took some shots of me and he sent them to Canadian Yachting Magazine. And I was the first centerfold for Canadian Yachting Magazine, but totally covered in mud, so you couldn't see anything.
But that episode, when those shows were aired in Europe on the Travel Channel in 25 languages, and they're on around the world in all these countries, and that episode was banned in a number of the Muslim countries,
Dubai and places. So, yeah.
Oh well,
we didn't really show anything. It was just
we did.
Oh, from a distance. Anyway, it was great fun. The shows are really fun.
So I remember, the only mud bass I remember are in Volcano in the Aeolian Islands.
Yes, that's true. No, they were good fun. We did stop at them too, and then I think there was some more in Pantelleria we went to.
Now, the ones in the Volcano, once I'm soaked in that mud, I could smell that mud for days and days and days, no matter how much I showered and washed off. Is it the same with those mud bass that you were at?
No, they weren't, because I don't think they were a volcanic.
Oh, okay.
I think they were in Volcano, as I remember that. I remember going those ones too, but they weren't smelly, these ones, because it's not a volcanic island. It was just mud that formed in the island. And it wasn't commercially set up anyway. You just wandered into the island and there was mud.
All right, so I'm going to conclude this interview. Tell me what you're going to talk about the next time I call you. Where do you want to cover it? Because I know you've done a lot of traveling in the Eastern Mediterranean that most people have never been to.
We were very lucky to get to do that and would be happy to talk about travels in Syria. We docked up in Latakia in Syria. We went to Lebanon. Lots of great places there, and also Turkey, where we got as far as Istanbul and along the rest of the coast, as you've done also, and all the Greek islands we love. So the Eastern Med sounds like it'll be great. We made lots of programs on that area. We hung out for a few years in that area.
Well,
that'll be great.
That's great. I'm going to get this. I'm going to make sure I get this podcast out fairly quickly because I want people to know about you at the boat show if they're interested in visiting you there. So normally I would have just done some editing on this and got it out in a week or so, but I think I'll go ahead and get this posted today or tomorrow just to make sure people are aware of what you're doing and where you're going to be.
Thanks, friends.
Thank you so much, friends. Yeah, we appreciate that. And we look forward to an opportunity to talk to you again and share stories about the Med.
Thanks for listening. If you have any comments on the podcast, drop me a note, franz@medsailor.com, or use the contact form at the website. If you have some suggestions for future shows, let me know. If you are a company that provides services to sailors, such as a charter company, I'm always interested in interviewing you. If you're a marina in the Mediterranean that want to tell me about your services, I want to talk to you as well. I'm just looking to provide any information to my audience that might be useful to them. And if you're a dreamer, just dreaming about sailing, keep listening. If you have comments, let me know. And thanks so much.
Joe, you have something to tell me?
No, I don't think so.
I just got off the telephone with Bill Rutherford. Princeton can use a guy like Joe.
What?
Princeton can use a guy like Joe. His exact words.
That's unbelievable.
You're as good as in. I knew you could do it. Haven't I been telling you, every once in a while, you just gotta say, what the heck, and take some chances.
You are so right.
You've made me very proud.
I was just thinking where we might be 10 years from now, you know? Ha ha ha.